And welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound mixers, VFX gurus, animators, composers, and more. You name it, and we talk to them. And we're doing some talking on today's episode of Behind the Lens. And by the way, happy St. Patrick's to you all. Hope you're out there getting your green on. Maybe a little luck coming your way as well. Well, today we're taking a look at one film because the interview is long enough it deserves. It takes up almost an entire hour on its own. Hilarity ensues this week. Thanks to director, co-writer, actor Rob Taylor and co-writer, producer, actor Nick Costa as they discuss their wild and wacky, and those are the words, folks, new comedy film Raging Midlife. And what a wild and wacky ride it is. As is this interview. Raging Life stars Paula Abdul, Eddie Griffin, Walter Koenig, Emily Sweet, Nick Costa, Matt Zack, Daryl Mason, Brenna Smith, Rob Taylor, Macho Man, Judy Leavitt, Joseph Avial, and Danielle Vasanova. And it's the story of Mark and Alec, wonderfully played by Matt Zack and Nick Costa, respectively. Two fanboys who are on a quest to recover a cherished light lavender with emblazoned gold lettering 80s wrestling tank top worn by their idol, Raging Abraham Lincoln. After Tyler, a grieving daughter, determined to fulfill her late father's wish to be torched in the shirt, when he passes, outbids them. Needless to say, the juvenile mindset of these of Mark and Alex, who are now in their 30s or so, hilarity ensues as the two of them will stop at nothing to find and retrieve this beloved tank top that they lost as children. But they might get stopped. Might have a hurdle or two to overcome. That may include some romance as sparks fly between Alex and Tyler, and forcing Alex to choose between love and Mark and the ultimate piece of wrestling memorabilia. And how about a Viking funeral thrown in there for good measure? This is wild and wacky are the only words to really describe this film. It is hilarious. It is fun. It is fast. And I think you're going to have a great time. Now, as you're going to quickly hear in my exclusive interview with Nick Costa and Rob Taylor, it's not just Raging Midlife that's wild and wacky, but so are Nick and Rob, who bring so much laughter to this exclusive interview that we, all three of us, are kind of out of control at certain times during the 45, 50 minutes. So take a listen as we break down the entire film, starting with its inception back in 2002 and the decade-long process to bring it into the present of 2025. Needless to say, as you're going to hear the boys talk about, a lot of the jokes that would have landed in 2002, no way would they land today. So there has been a lot of retooling over the years to get the script into what it is now. And I think it's in a really good place, as you'll see on screen. As we discuss, we highlight the unique blend of nostalgia and pop culture references, the large cast, and approximately 20 different locations within Raging Midlife. Interesting is something you may not hear from other filmmakers or anywhere else in any other interview, are the challenges involved with securing a federal courthouse as a shooting location. Nick, who is also an attorney, although it didn't really help him in getting the courthouse, gives us all the ins and outs and hoops he had to jump through for this important location. Rob, as director, dives into the cinematography and working with cinematographer Eric Macy and developing a visual grammar inspired by 1980s filmmakers. Similarly, composer Lisa Molinaro's score and the 1980s-influenced Needle Drops featured licensed tracks and original compositions, which Nick in his attorney hat discusses in terms of licensing challenges and cost. This is such a key element in filmmaking, and so many independent filmmakers, especially first-time, second-time indie filmmakers, always keep that in mind. Your licensing challenges. You love a song, you want it, but what's it going to cost you? Can your budget? This may be a darling you have to kill. Or, as an alternative, as you're going to hear Nick talk about, you find a composer, you find artist who can give you that same vibe that you want, but with an original song at a very, very reduced price from what the hit is that you want it. Another interesting topic that we touch on are film tax credits and their impact on productions, especially with low-budget, no-budget, micro-budget indie films. But don't worry, we spend quite a bit of time talking about characters, character development, and casting, most notably with Paula Abdul in her role as Mary Todd. Paula delivers a really strong performance here with a character that has some depth and texture to her, and it's far different from any of the quote-unquote cameos that she has had in other films. This is an actual role that is integral to the story, and she makes the most of it and does a great job. And also, Star Trek fans, get ready. You're going to be tickled to hear what Nick and Rob have to say about legend Walter Koenig and his role as Otis, the owner of a vintage clothing store called Boogie Woogies, and how he kind of aids them in their pursuit for a funeral suit. And I'm not going to tell you now, you're going to have to hear it in the interview. There's some surprising information about the co-owner of this Boogie Woogie store and the actor who plays the co-owner. So sit back, relax, get ready to laugh, and take a listen to Nick Costa and Rob Taylor talking about raging midlife.
Hey, Europe Beam. Hi, this is Nick Costa. I was just about to text Rob Taylor and say, hey, I'm jumping on here. Get on here.
Hi, Nick. It's
Dick. Is it you? Behind the lens?
Yes, it's Debbie. This is me.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Is that Rob? Rob joined?
Yeah.
Well,
hi.
Hello, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm thrilled to be talking to both of you after witnessing this wild and wacky raging midlife.
Yeah, what'd you think?
It's wild and it's wacky.
Hey, that's what we were going for, so mission accomplished.
Well, you guys did an amazing job with this. I didn't know what to expect going into this film. The synopsis with the blast on it, it doesn't really give us the full flavor of what unfolds on screen. We even get an intermission. How lovely.
With a commercial.
You're right up there with Quentin Tarantino and Hateful Eight. You're giving us an intermission. And I'd prefer commercial to, you know, nothing. Quentin gave us nothing for intermission. So
yeah, that's right. We gave you a little something. That's right.
That's it. You.
It's only 24 seconds long, but whatever.
That's okay. It's eye candy.
Yeah.
It's eye candy and noise.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention it because, you know, the film... when you see the trailer, we try to do a job where you don't really get the whole story. You don't want to see the whole movie in the trailer, and we hope that when people watch it, they're left going, I could not predict what was going to happen next in this damn thing.
you did that, the trailer intrigued me. And I think I even emailed Kim and said, I have to take a look at this film.
Nice.
So you have enough in that trailer that it whets the taste buds.
That's the idea. Keep them wanting more, you know? Make them curious, like kittens.
When this film started and I'm watching, you know, wrestling, and this is the kind of wrestling that, you know, when I was growing up in the 60s and even in the 70s, the campiest wrestling of all is what was happening. I start watching this and I'm like, oh my God, I'm in a time machine. I have gone backwards 50 years. Yeah,
that means the mission accomplished. That's what we wanted. You know, feel nostalgic.
You know, I don't think you meant to take anybody back as far as I went back in my memories. And seeing Paula Abdul there, and I'm just like, oh my God, what is this and where is it going? Then we've got these three kids there, and the one, her hair is set on fire, and then Mark becomes the savior, and he saves her, throws a coat on her to snuff out the flames. But that's not really, no appreciation was there, clearly, as the years went by. Which just sets us up for the present day. Which is hilarious because you've got Alex and Mark who are trapped in the past obsessing over this Rage-a-mania t-shirt, tank top. You just go on this loony, it reminded me of Rat Race.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Very much reminded me of that, of Rat Race as Alex and Mark going from the pursuit of this. You incorporate everything pop culture in there with delivery men, porch piracy.
We had to be, yeah, we had to definitely update the script a little bit to make sure it was nice and current and what the feels and squeals people have to deal with these days. That's right.
Oh my God. So I've got to ask you, where, especially since you just said you had to update the script, how did you come up with this idea? Were you guys sitting at breakfast and eating cornflakes and it's like, gee, this would be fun. How did this all start?
It evolved in many ways over the years. I remember actually sitting in a dark movie theater. Nick was next to me, and I said, I have the loosest idea for a movie. We've got a couple of friends who lose something on an online auction, something that means a lot to them. And they get outbid at the last second by username blank, 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 and they have to find this person and get the item that's rightfully theirs, and the name of the movie will be this username, which it was for the longest time, but we eventually changed the name of the movie.
Yeah, so the skeleton was there, and this is, by the way, like 2002 or 2003.
Wow.
And
when I said the idea, yeah, probably 2002.
Yeah, yeah. And we kind of had a little sit-down powwow with me, Rob, his twin brother, Neil, and the other lead in the film, Matt Zach. And I believe, dare I say, Rob, if I'm not wrong about this, I believe it was Matt Zach that came up with, hey, it should be the tank top that Kurt Russell wore in Big Trouble in Little China. And everybody just roared and said, yes, this is it.
Yeah, it was totally Matt's idea to make it that, the Big Trouble in Little China tank top, which it was for many years. We eventually had to adjust it to make it a little more accessible to a general audience, which is why it's wrestling now. But mm-hmm. The bottom line is, Matt picked a tank top back then, and because of how dense the script was surrounding a shirt, it had to stay a shirt. We just had to figure out what a more accessible shirt would be for the audience.
And to be honest, if I'm telling you the real dirt, it wasn't until I went to law school and in the interim, so that Rob and I could get some funding for this movie and every other movie at the time, because we were literally in his in Oregon City in his barn making sci-fi action adventure comedies for no budget. And so in law school, I remember on Halloween, me and my law school friends dressed up. I was Macho Man. Another guy was like Ted DiBiase, Million Dollar Man. Another guy was like all these 80s wrestlers. And then it just kind of struck me. I was like, you know what? Hulk Hogan has that famous tank top that he tears off each and every time he's about to go into wrestling bedlam, wouldn't that make a good substitute? And I approached Rob, and he was like, okay, we're on to something. And then, of course, you know, going to law school, you learn things about intellectual property and getting sued by people. But we also learned about parody.
Parody.
And so we learned, we can get away with it if we make our own wrestlers. And so it was Rob's idea to come up with this wrestler, Raging Abraham Lincoln, with, you know, infused with some of our favorite wrestlers. One of, obviously, mine being Macho Man Randy Savage. And so he's kind of a hybrid between Honest Abe and Mr. Savage.
That's right.
But I love the fact you started this in 2002. So, yeah, you had to go through a lot of updating and development over the years.
Some of those jokes weren't going to land in 2025.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure even some of the pop culture references of 2002 that you probably had in there would not land today.
We had to make adjustments, and there's scenes where someone's on the telephone. Oh, but they get caught up by the cord. Now they're hanging up the phone. It's like, okay, yeah, people don't have those phones anymore.
I hate to dispute that with you because I'm on one of those phones right now.
All right. There's still a few kicking around.
I hate to break it to you, Rob, but so am I, actually, so sorry, dude.
I swear by my hardwire, copper line, old landline phone. I will fight to the death to keep it. When the satellites, when those satellites fall from the sky, Nick and I are still going to be talking.
That's right, and I'll be out in the dust, alone and cold.
Well, that's your fault. Analog is coming back. Analog, everything.
That's right.
You know, especially.
I have a bin full of collectible rotary phones. In a shed somewhere, so I'll be all right.
I don't doubt that.
And that's a good thing to have. I probably have 3 or 4 sitting packed away myself. You never know. But
when it goes dark, we're going to need those phones.
That's just it, because those copper lines, they'll still be working.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I love the detail that you brought to the story, how you translated that visually, but also the characters are so well fleshed out. And what a cast of characters. This is a massive cast, really.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at everything, all your different wrestlers, the interviewers, I mean, this is a large cast for what I like to call low budget, no budget, micro budget film. That you can finance after you've gone to law school and you've made just enough money that you can spend it all and put it into a film.
Right. You nailed it.
I've been there, done that. So I know exactly what you've done. How difficult was it creating all of these characters and giving them so much vibrancy and life?
So when we wrote the original script way back in the day, we actually wrote ourselves into the script then. So Nick and Matt were always Alex and Mark, and I was always Rob. And Bruno was always Denise, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Or maybe that kicked around, but yeah. And then the rest of the cast was sort of curated over time. And you know, we kind of like to let the actors help dictate what their character is going to be, and if they can't do it the way we want it, then we just play those parts.
Well, I have to say, I love what you did in terms of the characters. And when you say, you know, the actors themselves, Eddie Griffin is perfect as El Duque and Walter. The dialogue that you have, that whole scene in Boogie Woogies involving Walter, I was roaring. Roaring.
That's an example of a scene that was untouched since 2002.
And
untouched, but expanded. The only thing we did was Walter, for this film, had two demands because he was in our last film. And he said, listen, Nick, I want to do this new film, but I'm not going to come back and do the Russian accent. Chicago. I'm an actor. I don't want to do the accent. And I said, done. And he's like, one more. I want my wife, Judy, to be in the scene with me. And I was like, can she act? And she, not only could she act, she came on. So we kind of basically split his role into two and turned it into kind of a, you know, mom and pop princess, you know, the Princess Bride, Miracle Max, and Carol Kane, you know, Billy Crystal vibes. And she came on and, dare I say, stole that scene from her husband, and to the joy of Rob and I and everyone else on set. I mean, she was fantastic.
Now, that scene, that whole thing in Boogie Woogies is just an absolute scream. But I'm listening to the dialogue and hearing the arguments, and she's pointing out, okay, this is the suit you need for a funeral, and talking about what they are, and we aren't going to say what they are because we're not going to give away the spoilers that make this scene so funny. And to hear what Walter's character of Otis is saying, I was roaring. And I think everybody who watches this film is going to pick up on that entire scene and all of the references you have in there. And
isn't it kind of nice that we have a Star Trek alum basically trash-talking a Star Wars moment? I get very tickled thinking about Walter Koenig basically trashing on Star Wars a little bit.
And you expect that. You expect that with any of the veterans of either franchise. And you hope for it. You actually hope for it.
Yeah. Part of the fun.
These characters are just so well fleshed out. Paula Abdul as Mary Todd. Oh my God. And the transformation of her from raging Abraham Lincoln's manager to a bar owner and bartender. Amazing. We get to see a bunch of growth and change in that character and in Paula's performance. You don't normally think of Paula Abdul as an actor who can transform like that within the confines of a script and do it so believably, but she does.
Yeah, we were very pleased and surprised by her performance. She rolled in and she was very flattered, you know, very intrigued in the project because for once, film was not trying to just use her as a Paula Abdul singer pop icon stereotype. We wanted her to play an actual part.
Yeah.
And so she was very committed and she rolled on the set and she blew us away. She was wonderful.
I really enjoyed her performance and to see that change in the character because it was so believable. And that's not normally, based on the cameos that she normally gets, that's not something that you would ever think you'd say. The believability.
Yeah.
She really pulled it off. But you,
but
you get this amazing, Daryl Mason does a great job as Tyler, and that's a real surprise. And I have to say, Nick, you and Daryl have great chemistry.
Thank you.
Great on-screen chemistry.
Yeah, we discovered that on the day when we auditioned her. We auditioned three different actresses for that role. Another actress was very promising, but Daryl had more chemistry with Nick. They were a better match. So she ended up getting the role.
Yeah, you really, it's very grounded, it's very authentic. I love the scene in the restaurant going back and forth with each other. It's tit for tat. It's very well constructed. Your character dynamics and the engagement scenes between pairings really is very, they're all very well thought out. I'm curious how challenging that was in the script process to come up with scenes that are that cohesive between the pairings, such as Alex and Mark, or Mark and Denise, or Alex and Tyler, or Rob and everybody. Rob works well in every scene.
Thank you. I have a little bit to comment on that. Since we've known Matt Zach since we've been in high school, the role was so written for him, and the chemistry and dynamics were... We knew well how they were going to turn out because we just knew each other well. And Nick, do you want to comment on the chemistry with Ariel a little bit?
I sure do. So, you know, even when at the audition, this, you know, she's a new actor. I think this is the first feature that she had done. And she came in with a three-ring binder full of, you know, the script with all these post-it notes. And I remember looking at that, and, you know, she was still a little raw during the audition, but I remember turning to Rob afterwards and thinking, you know what, she's going to put in the work. And boy, does it show on screen. As far as the writing is concerned, rewrites over and over again, and making sure the story had layers. Even Paula's part, when she first read it, I mean, she did this project because it's the script.
Mm-hmm.
But when we first sat down with her and her representative, you know, she was like, listen, I love the script, but my part, I would like it to have a little bit more, and her words were meaning and flair.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave a moment's pause, and I was like, done, and went back up to this little cabin up in the mountains of Mount Hood up here in Oregon, and I just kind of retooled her character and just added more layers to it. And I remember coming back to the table to present the script to them, and I told her, I was like, you know, Paula, even if you say no to this, I want you to know that you've helped this story. These characters are better. The story, the film is better because of this note. And thankfully, she agreed, and she was like, "Yeah, let's do it." But yeah, it's revisiting it and just kind of asking yourself, okay, what do the great comedies have? Yes, they're funny, but they've got heart.
Yeah.
They've got layers. They've got story, and the characters, you're rooting for them. You want them to win or you want them to lose. And I feel like that we haven't seen in some time. I haven't seen a good John Hughes movie since John Hughes. So that's kind of what we were going for with that script and the rewrites. And thankfully, I had Rob there to keep reminding me, story, Nick, story.
Something that stands out is that while we have Alex and Mark and their antics, the antics of each character, they meld well together, but each stands out on its own with its own kind of wackiness, especially the character of Mark. Of course, Alex, Nick, you give freneticism and obsession new meaning with your performance. But
you
really rely on your supporting players to bring the heart to this story. As Paula said, flair and meaning. It's in your supporting players where you really get, you expand, and that's where we see and feel the emotion and the meaning. It just is so beautiful to see that, so that it frees Nick and Matt up to just be wacky.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love that it's your supporting players that are adding the heart and the grounding to this story. So you really spread the wealth around.
It's an ensemble. At the end of the day, it's hard to put, you know, the crown on anybody's head here, because we all, like you said, support, all the characters support the others and just give this so much body that you just, like you said earlier, you know, for an independent film to have so many characters and locations, it's just kind of unheard of, you know. And fortunately, we actually had a lot of help with some film incentives here. I got to thank the Oregon Film Office, Tim Williams over there, who really supported us throughout this thing, because it isn't just you know, the laws of the lawyer money that keeps this thing afloat.
That's
It was the support of a lot of people and the governor's office here that loved the story and wanted to help, and they did. So
that's why the tax incentives, film incentives, are so important and critical, especially for these small, low-budget, no-budget, micro-budget films. And I think there are a lot of state legislatures that don't quite get that and understand that those incentives will ultimately bring more to the economy and more to the region and more notoriety. So I love hearing that. I love hearing that.
And keeping the crew as W-2 employees, making sure people get, hazard pay and things, because otherwise they just become independent contractors and they're not taken care of. So it helps. It really does help not just the communities, because we're pouring money into the, buying the craft services and renting the spaces, but also to the below the line people that depend on, you call it a microfilm. I don't know. I hate to tell you this, Debbie, but this thing cost $1 billion. That's the big secret.
Well, obviously, the cost went into the T-shirt and into the Viking funeral.
That's right. That's right. Okay, had to go somewhere, right?
It had. It clearly went for the T-shirt and for the Viking funeral. You know, those little horn helmets cost a lot.
Yeah.
How many locations did you have for this film?
Oh, man. Do we have a number on that?
I have to look at all the signed releases that I have collected. Gosh, I'm going to go ahead and say off the top of my head, 20 or more?
Yeah,
wow.
That seems like an accurate number right there, about 20, which for an indie movie is a lot.
Yeah, that's
usually an indie movie is to someone's bedroom.
That's ambitious. As I'm watching the film and I'm seeing all these different locations, ambitious was the word that popped into my head to tackle, because you got to set up, break down you with every single one, and that cuts into your shooting day. It shuts into your overall time element. So yeah, that was very ambitious, but you pulled it off.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, try getting a. I'm a lawyer. You'd think of getting a federal courthouse wouldn't be a big deal, right? Although the GSA, the USGSA, made me work to get that courtroom scene in the beginning, and I flew to D.C. to get it done. I mean, so a lot of this was not just a quick phone call and a knock on the door. There was a lot of hoops that needed to get jumped through to make it happen.
Wow. Now, Rob, once you've got everybody cast, the script is done, you're getting ready to shoot. Talk to me about the actual shoot, and particularly working with your cinematographer, with Eric Macy. I'm curious, because this film has such fluidity and so much movement and motion to it. And this is where your visual grammar is really going to come into play, and the ability of your cinematographer in terms of camera movement and what you're doing. So I'm curious about your work with Eric and how you developed a visual grammar and shooting style.
Yeah, I've got plenty to say about that. Eric is a sweet man and very experienced, and him and I worked very well together. He's got a lot of experience to the point where I tell him the vibe I'm looking for, and then he can just start sending grips and lighting guys around to get the scene lit. You know, some of the shots, a good handful of the shots, I had very specifically something in mind. I did a lot of storyboards and brought them on set that we could follow to the letter. And then sometimes I didn't have time to get the storyboards done, so him and I would just put our heads together and decide how to shoot it. But yeah, it was a cohesive experience working with Eric. Would work with again.
Yeah, and I notice you really shy away from extreme close-ups here. You use a lot of mid-shots, mid-two-shots that work well, because I think almost every scene in the film has 2 to 3 people at a minimum.
Well, I tell you, I was when I told Eric what I wanted, I was like, well, look at Steven Spielberg's work in the 80s. He also has a lot of mids and wides. Because as we were making a movie that was supposed to be a nostalgic throwback for 80s kids like ourselves, I want the audience to unconsciously feel like they were watching a movie made in the 80s. So we did a lot of studying of Spielberg, John Hughes, 80s filmmakers, and now you've got the result. A little mixture of everything, but yeah, we were leaning cinematography style for the 80s.
And I like your exteriors. I like your beach scenes. Those look beautiful, and you go wide on those. And the same thing with our Viking funeral. And that area that you shot that in, and the waterfalls and all, that is so beautiful. Really beautiful. And I'm glad that you guys went wide with that. So we get the full flavor of the situation, so that when finally, when we have Alex and Tyler sitting and talking to each other after Mark's antics, we really feel the intimacy of that moment. And it's really nicely done. And it's because of what you did with the camera.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
You know,
I'm sure Eric would like to hear your praise on his work. I think it came out quite lovely.
What happened when you got in the editing room? Because comedy is always very hard. It's tough to cut. You got to find those beats. And here you have so much physical comedy happening. What was that editing process like for you with your two editors? I'm curious about that dynamic.
Well, we hired professionals, Luke Kay and Hayden. I forget who I think. Those boys know what they're doing. So they gave us some help on our previous film after we had a cut. They kind of, or Luke rolled in and sort of told us how we could tighten it up and gave us a few pointers. And then for this one, we just handed the footage over and we got rough cuts back. We gave notes. And it was lovely. It was the easiest editing experience I have ever had because I wasn't editing it.
That was the nice thing. Yeah, this wasn't Anora, where the guy does the directing, the editing, and everything in between. We get 4 Oscars for it, but no, we handed this one off to actual professionals. Hayden Whelan and Luke Kay, these guys, especially Luke, Luke's star has risen. In fact, when I approached him for this film, he was like, he had just finished Guns Akimbo.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when we found him during the last film, he was coming out with this little film called Hunt for the Wilder People by this relative unknown Taika Waititi. And so we kind of struck gold finding him. And he's always been so supportive and has carried us through, even though, you know, he's in the super big leagues now. He's never forgotten from whence he came and, carried us through this. And that's him and Hayden's edit. Besides beyond notes from Nick and Rob, that's all them.
Well, I was familiar with Luke and his work. I saw and covered Hunt for the Wilder People and Guns Akimbo. So I knew right away what Luke was capable of doing when you put something footage in his hands.
We needed a man in new comedy. We sought him out because we saw Turbo Kid, and I was like, yes, this guy gets it. That kind of retro kind of comedy, and retro feels that we had in our last film. This guy had got it, and I was laughing from cover to cover of that film, and I was like, Rob, I gotta find this guy. I had no idea he was in New Zealand.
Well, you know, working with Taika, that's where you're gonna find him.
Yeah.
Some of the best filmmakers I have found, especially the technicians, are down in Australia and New Zealand. Maybe it's because they're sequestered from the lunacy of everyone else. But you look at the horror films that come out of Australia and New Zealand, you look at some of the editors, the cinematographers, and it's exemplary on every level.
Yeah, I agree.
But you really lucked out getting Luke. I'll tell you, you really lucked out.
Well, that's a start, Debbie. Rob and I can be very charming when we need to be.
Well, clearly, you were extremely charming. Putting this film together. And it begs the question, Nick, because here you are, you're one of the primary stars in here. You're on screen, 75-80% of the time, if not more. You're a co-writer. Was there fluidity in terms of ad-libbing, number one, so that as you're acting, you're thinking, no, I really want to change that. Or Rob is saying, no, we're not going to use that. Let's do it this way. So you're killing your darlings in your head while you're acting. But then you're also worrying about money and everything else as a producer.
Yeah. Let me tell you something, Debbie. They don't tell you the truth about rock and roll, okay? You know, until you've done it, And this is the second time I was quote-unquote producer. You just, like, don't realize what you're really getting yourself into, because you're right. There was a lot of, oh, my gosh, I need to act tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., yet I got to make sure all of these sides are exactly as we need them to be, so the story is cohesive. And by the way, everybody needs their call sheet as well. And, you know, I have a problem with wanting to do everything myself, so I learned a little bit about delegating on this one. But, you know, having actually put together the as broadcast script, I had to compare what was actually said on the day versus what was actually written. I'm happy to report that, for the most part, everything is to script.
Wow.
But of course, we would have, this is a Rob invention, we would shoot it, get it right, and then Rob would say, okay, one for fun. And that became a colloquialism on the set. And usually that one for fun, even if it was off script or a little bit modified, would be the one that we used. In fact, even somehow Paula got on board with the one for fun, and so she did one or two or three of those as well. So everybody got in. Everybody got in on it. So that was cool. But yeah, it was the other day, pretty much to script actually. So
wow,
Wow.
But now I'm thinking, because there is so much happening in every scene here, Rob, from a directorial standpoint, it kind of feels like you need to stay to script when you have so many antics and so much wackiness happening between the characters. Would that be a fair assumption?
Absolutely. There's one thing I discovered while we were shooting the first phase of this movie, and I just kind of had to go in the corner and out by myself. I was like, we're shooting this so fast. I don't have time to come up with new brilliant things on the day. I don't have time to get this and that just right. As far as other movies go, it's not necessarily shot fast, but it was fast for me. So it was kind of run and gun, and we kind of had like a four take rule on every line or every scene. Like if we're going past four takes, we're doing something wrong. But I'm also very welcoming to improv, mm-hmm. because sometimes you'll get brilliant stuff that you just can't write, and that's why I would always do one for fun, because the actors are very clever and often give me something that I could never have come up with on my own.
Well, I've got to ask you, Rob, as the director, did actor Nick actually take direction, or did he just try and go off on his own and pull out his producer's hat and say, I'm a producer, I'll do what I want?
No, Nick maintained respect for his director on set. He ran the show otherwise, but when I told him what to do, he would fucking salute me and say, yes, sir, and he would do it, and he would see why I was telling him to do it. I wouldn't tell him to do it for fun. My direction had a lot of purpose, which he would usually understand immediately.
And Nick, for you, what do you think of Rob as a director? Would you want to have him direct you again?
Well, the answer is yes, and I have. And this, to be honest, is the third film that I work with Rob on, and he has gotten better and better every time I work with him. In fact, I don't know if I could have done it without him, and he's got such a wonderful analytical understanding of filmmaking that, you know, where I'm jumping in going, okay, let's make this thing funny, I've got Rob there to kind of rein it in and be like, okay, now wait a minute, how does this serve the story, like I said earlier. As far as run and gun, you know, we did shoot for 33 days.
Oh my God.
Exactly run and gun.
No. It's true. There were just times when I thought we would shoot like three scenes in a day, and I was like, and my actors did fine. I was just more worried about getting it lit and shot properly. So the shooting was the only part that I was like sort of nervous about getting done a little too quickly. The performances were great, pretty much right away, because our performers did some rehearsal, but they didn't rehearse.
And it's nice to have someone like Rob who is committed to getting it done and getting it done right and not getting distracted at things like, hey, this Paula Abdul is sitting in front of my old high school friend Nick right now. It's all business. I think you even mentioned once, Rob, that like I think a few days after that shoot, you were like, oh, that's kind of cool. It was a pop icon in our film. It just doesn't get saved, which is great, because Sony, even I was a little nervous on that day.
Wow. Yeah. Now, there's another element of this film that's very important in here, and that is your score, your needle drops. For each of you, number one, what were you looking for musically in terms of score and your needle drop songs, but also based on what you wanted, what Rob wanted, what both of you may have wanted, how did licensing of the individual tracks impact your work, Nick, in terms of budgeting?
Rob, do you have something you want to add there? Because I could tell you the whole story.
Well, it is kind of two questions in one. There's the score, and then there's the soundtrack.
Yep.
The score, I just wanted it to sound like 80s scores, which is one of the best music for movies that ever came out. People like John Williams and Danny Elfman, who give these very exciting, Alan Silvestri, great scores, and I just wanted to have that kind of musical feel throughout. And then the soundtrack, take over, Nick.
Yeah, well, the score was done by Lisa Molinaro, I would add, who made a name for herself playing with at the viola with Modest Mouse for 10 years. And so she did a remarkable job on the score. It was her first time, too, ever making a soundtrack. As far as the needle drops are concerned, there's a Billy Bragg song in there, A New England, that I absolutely loved and just needed to have. And I flew to London to bang on Warner Chappell's door to get their attention because they were not replying to my emails. And I got their attention. So it went from having to fly across the world for a song to opening it up to musicians locally. And to be honest with you, some musicians were, this band, Glenn and the Sunshine Gang, who just like, I don't know whose friend it was, just came out of the woodwork and was like, hey, I got an 80s vibe, and I think we ended up licensing like 7 songs of theirs. I just loved the sound of it. It just worked exactly what we were going for. But others
that
were
nostalgic feel.
Yeah. Others we were flirting with some bands, like the Idols, and then we found this all women group called the Lambrini Girls in the UK, because I had a friend that was living out there who was like, you gotta listen to these guys. And that took, right, that was just going back and forth. I didn't have to fly all the way to London for that one, but it was just great to have a wide swath of just everything from punk to just like 80s and new wave feels in this, that by the end I'm like, you know what, if you hate the movie, you're going to love the soundtrack. The soundtrack slaps. What can I say? We nailed that.
Yeah, it's a great soundtrack. I want it on vinyl.
Now, see, that's what you have to do with this one. It needs to be on vinyl to go with the whole vibe of the film.
Totally. We all remember Ferris Bueller. You know, there's songs that, like, will probably never resonate but for a film. And then you watch the film and you're like, yes, that song. You know, and so I hope that if people watch this one, go, oh, my God, yes. Remember the film because of the soundtrack and vice versa. It's add that to your quiver, folks, on your Spotify afterwards, okay? You're welcome.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, now, the film, and actually, I am just tickled for you guys. You actually have some theatrical releasing.
Right.
It's not a wide release, but it's in select theaters in various parts of the country and on demand next Friday. So people have something to look forward to next week. So now you're getting ready for this to be unleashed on the world.
Yes.
And unleashed is the right word with the wackiness in Raging Midlife. I'm curious, for each of you, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker in making Raging Midlife that you can now take forward into your future projects?
I am happy to start, and it's very early, but, and I would say this to Rob, because every time we would get another, this is a little film that could, and does, I often remark, because we just kept pushing pushing the envelope. And by the end, I think I realized, you know what? We can do anything. We really can do anything. If you just want it, you just pick up that phone call. You pick up that phone, you call Paul Abdul's people. You know, we actually wrote her into an entirely different screenplay in 2003. And when I was writing it, Rob said, you know, why are you writing Paul Abdul in the script? Why are you writing The Impossible? And I'm like, if I don't write it, it won't become possible. And so by the end of this experience, I can say that you can literally, you can really do anything, so long as you've you put your head down and you can take the slings and arrows that come your way. But of course, you gotta keep it fun and you gotta keep it positive, because at the end of the day, people don't want to come play with you unless you're fun to play with. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So, I think especially with our budget, people jumped on board. Yeah, people were just like, "Oh, you guys are doing a cool thing. Hey, we're doing a cool thing. You want to do a cool thing with us?" At the end of the day, it's as simple as that, and a good script. Let's face it.
And what about for you, Rob?
You know, the thing about it is I learned to stick to my guns, and which I'm open to collaboration, but identifying when something's a good idea and when something isn't is very important, because there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen sometimes, and you have to remind everybody, thanks, but be quiet. I'm running the show. And, you know, honestly, there were times when I might have taken a few too many ideas than I should have when I watched the final product, and what I learned about myself is stick to my guns even harder next time, because a director's voice comes through in a movie, and if there's too many voices, it becomes mud. So what I've learned is to stick to my guns even harder so that my voice in the next movie is more pure, which will just make the movie better and more individual and more memorable.
Are you two working on anything else now?
Well, that's yes.
Yeah,
I love this question, because then I get to talk about the musical that we're going to do.
Oh, God.
So I had this little brainchild. I think I came up with this in 2003 as well, but it really just ended up as a treatment. But, you know, Paula, our very last day of shooting, was like, well, what's the next thing? What are you guys doing next? And I was like, it's a musical, Paula. And she got really excited. And I was like, okay, so here's the deal. And so, Rob, since you were, I'm just going to go ahead and just tell you. So it's basically about a group of kids trying to save their theater program in Alabama. But the Alabama people don't want to go watch the theater show. So the kids have to come up with an idea that will bring the people to the theater to save their program. So they come up with a Predator the musical, a stage version of the feature film, you know, set to music. And the kids put it on, but of course, as they're putting the show on, the townsfolk are blown away by the special effects, because all the kids are exploding on stage like they're really dying. They are, because it turns out one of their teachers is a 900-year-old vampire alien bent on eating the town. And Paula was like, well, who do I get to play? And I'm like, well, I'm hoping you'll be the 900-year-old vampire alien bent on eating the town. And she's like, does it have to be 900 years old?
She can be a very well-preserved 900-year-old.
You know what? Vampires live forever. That's right. That's right.
That's
so.
Oh, my. Now,
she wants me to send the script to her, but, you know, I got to polish a few things off and maybe address that concern before we do.
I think you definitely need to get that.
Comedy. Apparently, that's what's coming next.
Well, you guys really need to get to work on that one, because that definitely, you have now just thrilled me with that whole idea. So that's definitely something I would want to see.
There you go, Rob. You can't back out now.
You cannot. You cannot.
It actually sounds like a lot of fun, and if we can get it done right, it would be hilarious.
Yeah, well, you're going to need a bigger budget, because if it's going to be a musical, even though it's at school and it's in Alabama and we know the money isn't there to make it a really grand and illustrious stage presentation by the students, you want it to look really glossy. I think you're going to need a lot of glitter confetti.
Midlife to be a raging hit. we can make this next one, because that's how the sausage is made, folks. It's not because of some lowly immigration attorney in Portland funneling his retirement into a film. It really takes a village, especially with something like that, because you're right, it's a bigger concept. It's going to take some real dollars.
Yeah. Guys.
Indeed.
This has been so spectacular talking with you today about Raging Midlife.
Thank you, Debbie. This has been wonderful.
I mean, my God. I mean, I hope we get to chat again in the future, because you guys are just too much fun, and you have such creative minds, and you let the wackiness flow. And
Well, thank you. You
know how to translate it to the screen, so that other people can enjoy that wild wackiness too. Job well done, boys.
We hope that they feel that wackiness and enjoy the ride as much as we did.
Now, will you be releasing this on VHS?
We could make a few custom VHS tapes for you.
I think that would be an incredible marketing idea. Because of the whole vintage feel, the 80s feel, because of the commercial. No, I think that would be great as a gimmick.
Mm-hmm.
Make like 100 copies.
I love it, Debbie. There you go. 10%. Get it done. You got the 10%. Let's do this.
Hey, you can cut my cut. I'll take 5%. So I'll lower my percentage. Oh,
that's an awesome idea.
Oh.
Really, that's a great idea. It'd be fun. We definitely love a little nostalgia. I'm sure someone's got a VHS player that still works out there.
I do.
Oh, I've got a couple.
I have three.
Yeah. How the tables have turned. Now you two are the ones with the archaic analog equipment that I don't have.
I love my analog. Love my analog. Well, gentlemen, as I said, this has been a joy. Job well done with Raging Midlife. And I can't wait till we get to chat again. And hopefully it's going to be about the musical.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we look forward to that. Hopefully, we just keep getting faster, too. So hopefully we'll talk to you sooner than later.
I sure hope so.
All right, Debbie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure.
And you go have a great rest of your day.
Oh, you too. Beautiful and boiling. All right. Take care, Debbie.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye, Deb. Bye.
And that was Nick Costa and Rob Taylor talking about Raging Midlife. It's now available on demand and showing in select theaters across the country. It just released on Friday. So it's a perfect film if you just want to kick back, relax, and forget about all the mishmash that's going on in the world today. It's a lot of fun, and I think you're going to enjoy it. So that is all the time we have this week. Join me again next week as we take a look at Appalachian Dog, another indie film, and chat with writer-director Colin Henning. It's a beautiful film. It's interesting. It's a period piece. So, until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.